Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Luke's English Podcast. And this is part two of a conversation that I'm having with Corneliu Dragon. Oh, God.
It's only worked the first time. People just go back to the first episode. And he was brilliant then. Brilliant.
Dragon Mirescu.
Yes.
Okay. Corneliu Dragon Mirescu is here with me. And if you've listened to part one of this conversation, then you will remember us talking about his name, the fact that he's from Romania, the fact that he's a friend of mine from the stand-up comedy scene, the fact that he's a filmmaker who has a great love and a great affection for movies. And we talked for ages about all sorts of stuff in the last episode, and we're going to continue in this one. And the plan is to focus on Corneliu's English learning experiences and to talk about Romania and the image of Romania and certain issues relating to that. That's the plan. But we know, don't we, on Luke's English Podcast, that the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. I think that's the phrase.
Absolutely.
So we will see what happens. The ultimate aim, as ever, on Luke's English Podcast is to keep you entertained, to give you a chance to listen to some real English as it's actually happening, as it's genuinely spoken in a real conversation, authentically, some organic English, let's say, to give you a chance to try and just keep up with the conversation, because in doing that, you engage in a very natural and organic way with English, right? And that aids in your acquisition of the language, ultimately. Keep listening. That's my advice. Okay. Luke's English Podcast is produced for you, for your listening pleasure. Pleasure? That's not how you say that word.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Pleasure. That's more. What's pleasure? I don't know. I've never said the word pleasure before.
It's something that we might have discovered just now.
I've just created a new word.
It's a new form of pleasure.
It's even better than pleasure.
Where you lose yourself into the universe.
It's a kind of pleasure where you lose yourself into the universe and you also learn English while doing it.
Yeah.
So listening to Luke's English Podcast genuinely is a pleasure, and I hope that you're taking great amounts of pleasure from pleasure.
Yeah, but that's secondary now.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, good. That's my introduction. And how are you feeling, Corneliu?
Pretty good. I mean, I was thinking about this concept of organic English.
Yeah.
But I think it's called bio here in France.
So. Bio, yeah, they call it bio, which is in England we would call it bio.
Yeah.
Bio English or bio English. It's funny because in England, bio is something else.
Bio.
Is it the same in America?
Bio.
It's a bad thing. You get it on the Paris metro quite a lot. It's basically body odor.
Oh, yeah. I know. I was thinking somewhere else. Yeah, right.
Sometimes, you know, French friends say to me, oh, well, let's go to the BO, you know, shop. I'm like, what? You can actually buy BO in France? Because I thought that it was readily available for free on the metro.
Yeah. But this one is, you know, you can have BOs kind of created by the... Like, I think Karl Lagerfeld would be a great guy to create different BOs.
Yeah, well, you know, Paris is well known for creating fragrances.
Yeah.
Some of them smell good, some of them smell bad.
But, you know, it's the passion that counts.
Exactly, you've got to have passion, in this country, yes. Passion is a very important concept in France and in other places. In Britain, we don't go in for passion so much. You know, in you go to France or we go to other countries, like, for example, sort of Latin nations and so on. And everyone's, you know, talking about passion. Football is my passion,
right.
That kind of thing. And in England, you know, we don't say, oh, it's my passion. We tend to say it's my hobby. you know.
Right. So it's just more laid back, sort of maybe, you do that, but you might choose not to do that. Not to practice the hobby.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't, for example, say stamp collecting is my passion, right, would you? You know, it's like stamp collecting is my hobby. I like to collect stamps. I put them in a book. It is my passion.
It comes with other types of gestures and movements when you you're using, when you're handling stamps, for instance.
Yeah, you've got to be very very delicate. You can't get too emotional about it. Yes, you have to have a stiff upper lip approach.
Yeah, that's what they say. Yeah,
yeah.
I wasn't able to assimilate that. I think.
Really?
Yeah, because being, like we were talking about learning English and all that, and being exposed to the British culture. And that's, I think, something that I didn't really achieve.
What, the stiff upper lip?
Yeah. Because my teacher wanted me to have a very good British pronunciation.
Right.
That was his aim.
Yeah.
But as you can hear, that didn't really happen.
Well, you've got good pronunciation. I mean, it's
but not British.
No,
he wanted the British, not necessarily BBC, but some form of British, a higher class, not Cockney. He wasn't going for Cockney.
No, I don't think so.
Nobody wants that.
Some English people do. Jamie Oliver, you know him?
He wants to sound Cockney.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, he does.
So you're saying that in the beginning he was speaking, he was like a Cambridge dude.
No, I don't think so. I think Jamie Oliver started speaking like that, and he's managed to maintain it.
He's
cultivated. I don't know if he's cultivating it, but it's certainly part of his roots. Jamie Oliver's if you don't know, is an English chef. He's quite famous now everywhere, and he's famous. He's famous for being a bit of a geezer. You know what I mean? He's like a bit of a. All right, so get your potatoes. Yeah, you chop them in half. Yeah, don't muck about. Just chop them in half. Stick them in the pan. Lovely. You know, he's a bit like, he's from Essex, I think, and in that part of the world, they do sort of speak a bit like that. You know what I mean? They've got a bit of a Cockney thing going on, and so he's the sort of Cockney chef, which is fine. It's great and everything. I love that sort of dialect and everything. It's brilliant. But sometimes people criticize Jamie Oliver because they think it's fake.
Right.
Like they think that he's putting it on, like he's cultivated it a bit and it's fake and he's doing it because it's part of his image.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh yeah, this is interesting, isn't it? Because he's a chef and he's quite sophisticated regarding food. But on the other hand, he's a fucking Cockney, isn't he? You know what I mean? He doesn't actually say the F word.
No.
I would beep that out, but I'm not going to, just because two reasons. One, I'm lazy. And secondly, I think it's all right. I think it's okay to swear a little bit sometimes.
Absolutely.
But as long as my listeners know that it's a bad word and that they shouldn't be using it on a daily basis.
Only
sometimes. Yeah. Anyway, your accent.
Yeah. So no, that didn't really happen. So because I guess after the study years, I was exposed then to all sorts of other influences that kind of built this sort of accent that I have now.
Mm.
And one of them being spending time in the U.S., but even prior to that, being exposed to a lot of American movies, kind of having my attention in that direction, and that probably built. And also, as I guess you would confirm that, it's an easier way of, I mean, more relaxed way of speaking. We know that Americans tend to go for the what's kind of easier to do, to pronounce, and they've simplified or taken out some sounds that exist in the British pronunciation.
Yes.
So I guess that's also part of that simplifying mode that I've been going that way.
Yeah. I think some people sometimes ask me, is it easier to learn British English or American English or whatever? I don't think that one is intrinsically easier to learn than the other, or that one is intrinsically clearer or better as a medium of communication than the other. I think they're two distinct and equally valid forms of English. I mean, that's what I say in a good mood. If I'm feeling tired, I'll say, no, British English is correct and American English is wrong. No, I don't actually say that. I don't, because I don't believe that. But I think sometimes people want me to say that, but I won't.
Right.
Because I don't really agree that I think they're both equally valid, right? What was my point, Cornelia? I can't remember what I was going to say. I was going to say something about... America generally, yeah, it's a very pragmatic place, and yeah, they have sort of modified English in some ways to make it simpler. Like they've changed the spelling,
right?
The pronunciation is sort of rounder. For example, you get the T sounds that tend to become like D sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The R sound is added in there in various ways. Yes. I guess you picked up an American English accent from watching a lot of movies,
yeah,
and from living in America for a while.
That came later, so I was probably accentuated a tendency.
Okay.
And since I've been also studying there and including acting lessons and obviously working on text and on interpretation,
yeah,
that made kind of put an imprint on what it's now easier for me to do. In terms of using my voice and in acting. Mm. So I've been facing kind of this issue even when acting in French, for instance.
Yeah.
And I find it much more... it's much better. It's easier to act in English,
yeah,
for me, because I've had this sort of formative experiences in English. And of course, easier in Romanian, because that's how things are.
It's your first language.
Yes.
So like learning acting, training as an actor in America meant that I imagine that you focused on your diction and focused on performing and your spoken performance in American English, and that's really fixed your accent in an American accent, which, you know, which is great. But how do you feel about that? You cool about having an American accent? Is that you're happy with it?
Yes. Of course.
Yeah.
Recently in Cannes with Alan, an American friend and colleague, networking there.
Yeah.
And we had a colleague from Egypt.
Yeah.
And he told me, well, you speak perfect American English, and for me, there's no difference between you and Alan. Now, obviously,
and you were like, yes!
I don't believe that, because I know that I have sort of an accent that's not even American.
Yeah.
But then I was kind of taunting Alan and just saying this, repeating this phrase, you know, Alan, there's no difference between us. And so I was sort of satisfied, but I know that it's not the case.
Okay, all right. So tell me about how you learned English, all right? Now,
sure.
You've got a bit of a story about this. So when did you start learning English? Can you remember the first time you had to speak or listen to English?
Well, listen, obviously, there were movies that we were... I was telling you that all the movies were in original version.
Mm-hmm.
So on TV or in cinemas, I was listening to that. And I was already going to the movies a lot. And so I had a lot of exposure to that.
Yeah.
But when I was about 8, my parents decided that it's time to take that seriously.
Yeah.
And, among the other many things that I'm grateful to them, it's this exposure to languages and good knowledge of English and French that took me in the directions that I took afterward. I mean, and career wise and life wise.
So they decided that you should learn English and French.
And French, but English came first. That it is obvious for everybody. This was the priority. You know?
Yes,
it was the 80s, communist Romania, but everybody somehow had this idea, had the hope that, you know, it would be even more useful one day.
Mm-hmm.
And things, for a family who could afford, and we were not a very rich family, by no means, a very, normal, I would say, family. But even, in this case, parents wanted the kids to learn good English, and so mm-hmm. took private lessons with tutors,
yeah,
private teachers who would come to our homes, or I don't know, some kids maybe went to their homes, to the teachers' homes, and they would have one-on-one, generally,
yes,
lessons. So that was kind of the situation in general.
They decided that Right, so they picked an English teacher who then came to your house.
Yeah. And there was sort of an audition thing, which went both ways, because the teacher would come and kind of talk to the parents, talk to you, and then decide. You know, every side was thinking things through, and then it was an audition.
You auditioned the teacher, and the teacher auditioned you
at the same time. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right. Yeah. So it's basically like okay. We'll have a lesson or two at the beginning to see if you like each other.
Right.
And the first teacher that you had, you how many sessions did you have with your first teacher? Do you remember? Was it like many sessions or just one or two?
I think there were several months, I would say. So I was about eight.
Yeah.
And the first teacher was this woman who had a particular method, meaning that she was drawing and singing. Right. Things for kids,
drawing and singing.
Yeah. So as we were just facing each other over a desk, and she would draw on a notebook.
Yeah,
and she had her set of crayons, and she was very skilled. I mean, I admired the artistry. Mm. As like birds, we'll learn about birds, but she took 5 minutes to draw a bird.
Yeah,
I was put off by that. You know, bird. I understand. I was able to recognize the bird. From the first strokes, the beak.
Yeah.
Beak, a couple of feathers, that's a bird.
That's a very good point, because like as an English teacher, sometimes it's necessary to draw pictures to help people understand vocab. It's a very important skill.
Yeah.
But you learn as a teacher that sometimes you just need only the basic things.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to draw a bird, you can just draw a piece. It can be a really badly drawn bird.
Yeah.
As long as there's an eye there and a feather there and a beak there, that's all you need. And in fact, there's a great sort of skill involved in communicating a message through a piece of artwork.
Sure.
You know, it's like that game Pictionary,
right.
The one where you have to draw a picture and your partner has to guess what you're drawing.
Right, right.
And when you get really good at that, you learn that it's the shortest distance between your brain and your friend's brain, and it's like, what's the quickest way that I can express this concept in a drawing? And the people who are bad at that game, they draw very, very detailed pictures, and it takes a long time. No, keep it simple. Focus on the clearest, most simple method of getting the message across.
Sure.
It's the same in any kind of communication.
Absolutely. So that was kind of a bad choice, although she was a good drawer. But I was sitting there and waited for, very artistic drawings to pop up on the notebook. But that was, we had flowers springing on the notebook and all sorts of other animals and maybe even people, but I don't know if that was not very much about English.
So you were like, these drawings are fantastic, but really we need to focus on English.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, it took 5 minutes just to draw a picture for one word.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And also the other thing, which was her thing, her shtick, was singing.
Right.
She wanted to sing songs to learn English, which is done. I'm aware of that. I'm not against it. But it's more awkward when you're face-to-face in a small room and maybe with the parents next door, kind of listening in. Why not?
Mm.
And to sing in front of this person the alphabet, which is a
famous song.
Famous song.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
You will not make me sing it, even now. I refused then. I was eight, and I will still refuse it because it's awkward, it felt out of place. So I wasn't comfortable with this method, and I think everybody felt that. So after a few months, this person was thanked.
Yes. Thank you very much. But no, thank you.
Yes, yes. And I don't know exactly how that session went. I don't think I was there. I think my parents just took this, the initiative and just thanked her and then started auditioning for somebody else.
Yeah.
And so some friends, good friends, recommended a gentleman who was supposed to be very good, very thorough, very serious about the thing, and who came in and did the audition thing, which felt much more an audition on my side this time. Because he was teaching older people. And I was about probably 8, 9 by then.
Yes.
So I have to make sure if I can work with this kid, because I'm used to teach people who are teenagers or young adults or old adults or all that.
He was used to teaching grown-ups, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's in one word. Thank you for summarizing that before I was going on to list every sort of human form.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just doing my job. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's good. Now people have some vocabulary to work on,
yeah.
Right?
That's the idea, I suppose. Yeah.
And so he came in, and there was this talk, and I read some stuff, and kind of I was reading the Greek, legends, the old
myths.
We know in a book for kids, but still, you know, there's strong material.
Yeah, good stuff from all those Greek stories. Yeah,
you like that.
Hercules.
Yeah,
that
was, you know, marked points for me. So like that, had me read from a book that I was reading, and so I was reading fluently, obviously in Romanian because I didn't know English. But he was interested in kind of, I think, the intellectual level.
Yes.
And then we started this, and which went on for 4 or 5 years,
yeah,
I would say.
Wow.
So I was till I started high school, basically.
Yeah,
4 or 5 years, and it was great because I was, I guess, following with his method, and
yeah.
He was serious about it, but still knew how to kid with me to joke, and also again to tell stories.
Yes,
he was telling stories, even if some were probably more not necessarily for my age. It was interesting, and he was kind of opening paths and ideas for me. So he was a great guy, and I'm thankful that I met him, because you know the solid knowledge of English then brought me to America, but also now I'm working a lot in English, not only the stand-up but also writing in English, and even on different projects that I work. The good knowledge of English has always been an important point for me.
So
and this guy, his name was he's still around, Nicolae Alexandru Pokora. So you see already, long name, probably as long as mine with all three names.
Yeah,
and so he also, what's interesting, he made me do some physical exercises too, because maybe he saw that I was a bit kind of not very into sports even then, and probably a bit overweight as a kid. Not much, don't think.
You weren't a fat kid.
No,
you just like
you could have bit of
could have done with a bit more exercise, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So, and we had a session, like a break in the session, where I did about 10 push-ups.
Seriously?
In the middle of the session, a break for push-ups, 10 push-ups.
Really, really?
Yeah, give me 10. And I would execute that. And so I it's something that, you know, kind of kept me in shape a bit, too.
That's very interesting, you know, because, you know, about this theory that there are multiple intelligences, you know, about this,
right.
You know, like different types of intelligence. So some people are visual, some people are kinesthetic, which means that they like to do lots of physical movements when they're learning. Some people are musical, and various other different types of intelligence.
Right.
So I imagine that he realized the importance of, maybe I'm giving him a lot of credit, but maybe what in effect what he did was he tried to introduce a slight kinesthetic element, because you were rather rigidly sort of intellectual as a learner, and he thought, no, I need to do some more physical stuff, because actually learning language is not just an intellectual pursuit, it is a physical pursuit completely. I mean, it absolutely is physical.
Yeah.
You know, speaking,
adapting the vocal cords to
definitely, and not just the vocal cords, it's the whole body.
Yeah.
When you talk, you use your whole body. You might not realize it, but everyone does. Everyone uses their entire body. You can subtly, we affect our body language. We emphasize things by using our body language, and also we think physically too. I mean, it helps me to do that. It helps me to move when I think, because it allows me to put rhythm into my speaking, and it allows me to sort of map out what I'm thinking. You know, like when I'm on stage,
right?
It might be different on stage because there's a different factor, which is that you're entertaining. But I find that I can get my thought process, I can communicate my thought process more effectively when I'm moving on stage than when I'm standing still. I find that when I stand still on stage, my performance becomes smaller and less engaging. Whereas when I move, when I'm on stage, I find that I can make my points more effectively. Anyway, so what I was saying is that your teacher was really clever to introduce those push-ups, because he added the physical element into the learning process as well.
Yeah.
Also, he probably gave you a big rush of oxygenated blood to the brain.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, maybe he felt that at some point I was getting a bit not really sleepy, but probably less active intellectually.
Mm.
And also, I'm thinking now, because there's this concepts of, I guess, the a British gentleman who has all these qualities, including the physical ones, which is kind of a good,
posture.
Posture and being, you know, kind of skilled in sports, at least some.
Right.
Of course, being able to ride horses.
Yes.
I think that's kind of an old gentleman idea of a person who's complete, right?
Yes.
And probably he was, I'm just speculating, he was drawing from that too, because he was so enthralled with British culture,
right?
And he that was his model, and I wouldn't be surprised, because he was reading up a lot on British stuff.
Right, the concept of the gentleman who, as you said, the complete sort of gentleman, which is someone who has all the right sort of behavior,
right,
but also physically is in good shape too. It makes me think of someone like Sherlock Holmes, who we always think of him as a purely intellectual person, but actually physically he was very capable too as a boxer.
Yeah, as evidenced in the latest movies, but not necessarily in the old ones.
Yeah, well, exactly. In the new films with Robert Downey Jr.,
right,
who we mentioned earlier as Charlie Chaplin, yes, he's very much a fighter. He's a bare-knuckle fist fighter and everything. And there's some brilliant moments in those films where he chooses his technique for beating someone up, and he uses the Holmesian, you know, method for, you know, working out someone's weak points and all that. It's brilliant. But in the books, yes, he's an excellent boxer. So he's, you know, an example of that image of the gentleman, the physical and the intellectual combined. Yes.
So, yeah, that might have been one of the models. But a lot of emphasis was put on pronunciation, which was, you know, the British pronunciation. So this is where I was saying earlier that after my years studying with this guy, I kind of switched and have gone my own path. But he was very, you know, insisting on words, and that kind of got to us funny and a bit tense point when he also did lessons with my father.
Yes.
In the early 90s, my father needed that because he was going to work to study for the surgery technique in England.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in Leeds. And
my dad's from Leeds.
Oh, that's
coincidence.
Yeah. He knew English, but he needed, you know, to beef up a bit on English, because he was going to work and study under British surgeons. Mm. So he used the same gentleman whom I had studied with and probably was almost done by then.
Yes.
But he took lessons with him, and he needed just practical stuff.
Yeah.
And vocabulary and easiness into communicating.
Yes.
He had no time to focus on British pronunciation, but this guy was following his method, so he was insisting with his British pronunciation, and I was able to hear from another room kind of bits and pieces of this conversation, insisting, and my father, you know, kind of trying to do his best, but really not focusing on that, because that was not what he wanted out of these lessons.
That's very interesting, because as a teacher myself, you know, I realize that some methods work with some people and they don't work with others. There is no one perfect method. I mean, for example, your first teacher who used art and music, I'm sure she had great success with some people with that method, that people loved the music and the art, and that helped them to relax and so on. But what worked with you and what didn't work with your father, maybe... Yeah, as you said, your father, being a professional surgeon, didn't have a lot of time. Also, he already had a full personality, fully formed personality.
Yeah, I think that's important.
So what he needed was someone who would work with him on his terms. So like, I've learned that from some teachers, some students, you have to be quite a dominant personality and lead them. And some students who are usually older professionals, you let them be the leader, right, and you're there in a sort of consulting aspect, you know, just sort of giving them bits of advice and working with them, listening to them very carefully to see what's going to work with them, rather than imposing a sort of a method on them, you know. So yeah, that's very interesting that it didn't quite work with your father in the same way that it had worked with you.
And besides, now I recall that my father actually had studied initially with an original British gentleman who was a friend of the family, and who was living, he had married in Romania and was living there, and taught him some lessons, and so he had this exposure, but probably that wasn't his strong point, or didn't need to focus on that, but took the useful, let's say, concrete stuff, like being able to communicate.
Yes.
So he had already had that, and now had this update with our a gentleman, but that went fine, because he went and took that course in surgery, and which went great. He spent, I think, a month in Leeds.
Yes, really.
And he came back fully equipped with new techniques.
Well, great. And he used them to tame dragons, as we learned.
I think, that might have been one of the... But he became also the... one of the pioneers of laparoscopic surgery in Romania.
Really?
Which is very important and revolutionary in the early 90s.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. Okay.
What's interesting to say, if we really want to give a sense of these sessions in the 80s, English lessons.
These English lessons with this teacher who you respected so much.
Because my feeling is that we had so much more time back then. Part of it is because we didn't have any other form of entertainment, and there were 2 or 3 hours of TV program, and people needed to occupy their time. So people were reading back then the classics, all the great books were read.
Yes.
And for instance, even these lessons took a lot of occupied, like a whole afternoon, because you would have me working with the guy and doing our exercises, but then he would spend at least the same amount of time chatting with my parents.
Oh, really?
About my performance, but also about anything, you know, going on, or about life, or about
the news or whatever.
Exactly.
In Romanian or in English?
Mostly, that was basically in Romanian.
Yes.
But when my father took the classes too, he tried to use that time also to make conversation in English.
Okay.
I remember.
That's good.
Yeah. Or even if I would maybe step in, he wanted to give a glimpse of our progress. Yeah. So he would engage in a bit of dialogue.
Right.
With me in English in front of my parents.
Yes.
And even today, this is bound to happen if I'm going to call him.
Yeah.
At some point, which is not predetermined, so I would not know, in the midst of the conversation, he would switch into English.
Yeah.
And obviously I would do the same, because that's an invitation, right?
Yeah.
And knowing that he's judging my accent every step of the way.
Right. Okay.
But I what can you do about it?
What can you do?
Yeah.
You have to just go along with it, don't
exactly,
you?
Yeah.
Well, he sounds like a really good teacher. He used with you a series of books, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
You told me about these books before, written by someone?
C.E. Eckersley.
C.E. Eckersley. Yeah. Slightly mysterious character. Who is this C.E. Eckersley?
I don't think we have an indication of what it stands for, but this is a four-volume handbook that this guy used, and that was his Bible, because he was using just that for teaching. And we, you know, as we see here on the book, the first edition was published in 1940. And has enjoyed various editions ever since. Mm. And my guess from recollections is that we were using very old books.
Yes.
The ones that he had, maybe not from the 40s, but 50s, 60s at least.
Yeah.
And so they were adorned with very nice cartoons.
Yes.
Some from the papers, some drawn for the handbook.
Yeah.
And so it was I was still able to enjoy a bit of art.
Yeah.
With my English lesson.
There was a little bit of visual stimulus in there.
Yeah, I would enjoy that. But there was a lot of dialogue in it, and also exercises. So I was kind of surprised that, and you didn't know about this, and generally all the English speakers that I've talked to about this have not heard about it.
You mean you were surprised that I hadn't heard of this series?
Yeah.
So let me
but
just...
apparently it's not very well known.
I had never heard about it when you told me about it. Yeah. Let me just say, maybe some of my listeners, they might know the series as well. In fact, yeah. They may have had a very similar experience to you,
right,
Cornelius?
Well, I would enjoy if anybody knows of them or had experience with it, if they could, you know,
write
and make comments. Just leave a comment, and I would be happy to know that somewhere there. There's other people who studied following this method.
Let me just describe the book a little bit. What we have here, Cornelia has brought two of these books, which you purchased fairly recently online.
Yeah, on the internet, but these are more recent editions than the ones I studied from.
These editions probably come from the 70s.
No, this one was printed in the 90s, but it's a 70s edition.
Okay.
It's a reimpression.
It's a reprint.
That too.
Of the 70s. Right, okay. So it's called Essential English for Foreign Students by C.E. Eckersley, published by Longman nowadays. I'm not sure if they were always published by Longman, but I think...
Probably.
I think so. And there's, you know, small handbooks. It's like the size of a novel that you might take on holiday with you, you know.
I was able to stuff two volumes in my jacket...
Uh-huh.
This afternoon, so they're very practical.
I think that's my favorite size for a book.
Yeah.
It's enough to go in a pocket, a jacket,
really,
a
really.
Jacket pocket.
That's of great value. I was so depressed over, you know, I needed to take a book with me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't take the book that I wanted many times because of its size.
Yeah.
And especially the cover.
Yeah. I'm reading a book at the moment, Cornelia, which I've been reading... for months,
right.
And it's a book about the Beatles, because I'm a huge fan.
Sure.
And the problem is I cannot finish this book because it's too big. It's literally too big. I can't take it with me.
Yeah,
if I want to take it with me, I need to bring a backpack and put the book in the backpack.
Exactly.
So I'm never going to finish this book because I can't carry it with me on the metro. But these books are perfect.
They are perfect. Although, you know, I never carried them with me till today because the teacher was coming to our house for the...
I see. He brought the books.
And I guess we purchased, or probably... somebody who had already taken this class with him gave them to us, because people were kind of handing books to the next ones. Like I told you that this guy was recommended by some friends of the family, so maybe they had the four volumes and simply gave them to us.
So they were sort of handed down to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, hand-me-downs.
Yeah.
All right, so just tell me a little bit about these books then. They used to contain cartoons that appeal to you.
Yeah. I mean, I even remember, you know, like this is probably from the press, funny cartoons, like a gentleman eating a soup in a restaurant and the waiter next to the window looking outside, and the waiter says, "It looks like rain, sir." And the guy eating his soup, and it also tastes like rain. You know, kind of humor.
Yes.
but it features in the stories, let's say, that open the lessons. The situation is we're at a teacher's house, Mr. Priestley, who's teaching English to a group of foreign students from all over the world. Olaf, Pedro, Frida, Lucille, you can see here the variety. And a dude, Hob, who's from an imaginary country.
Hob.
Yeah. And he's kind of the comic relief, kind of lazy, but he still makes progress in English.
Okay.
No? So he was an interesting character to me, if we want to make a connection with kind of my choices later and comedy and all that. I got to say that he was an interesting guy.
Okay.
I don't remember the others very well. Just now reading the names, they come back. But and they were drawn with, you know, like a lot of attention. They were handsome people, let's say, that in the old drawings.
Yes.
And Hob was kind of sloppy and with the wrinkled clothes sometimes and messed up hair.
Right.
But because obviously there were insights of how to behave too, as we were talking earlier, on how people need to behave properly, especially if they want to fit in England.
Right, I see.
I think that's the point. Mm. I'm just assuming that now, but you know, you give a handbook to a person who will probably come into your country.
Yes.
And you want that person to be...
to behave correctly.
Yeah, to be, I mean, on all levels, not just language, but, you know...
Yeah, in terms of, you know, like the general etiquette for how to behave in the appropriate way within that culture.
Yeah.
So the book works as not only a language guide, but also a general cultural guide too.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's probably, again, why this teacher loved it and followed through in all its aspects.
Yeah, it looks like a good book, and it's it kind of each unit tends to have like either a lecture, sort of a couple of pages written by the teacher on one subject, and then a few grammar or vocab exercises afterwards.
Yeah.
Or there are conversations between the teacher and the members of the class,
right?
Including little comments by Hob.
Hob, yeah,
who makes like little jokes as you said, the comic relief, the light relief in there. And it goes through various different things, including... It seems that most units relate to grammar, but then there are things like a description of the teacher's trip to Oxford with vocab exercises.
You have there the third volume, so it tends to be more oriented towards, conversation and... I guess the grammar side is more dense in the first volumes, but the last volumes are more oriented towards culture and conversation and reading, obviously, and they offer all sorts of aspects that probably out of date. I mean, imagine that we were using books probably from the 60s, and that had been created in the 40s, so there was this myth, I guess, of England that I think it's pretty much alive, and it's been promoted through other channels.
The myth of what
like
England,
the gentlemanly
is.
England, right?
Yeah. I mean, does the gentleman still exist? Is this the question?
Yeah.
I think that it doesn't exist in the same way that it used to. People used to go to schools, like finishing schools, where you would actually learn how to act like a gentleman. So the gentleman was a thing that definitely existed, and it was something that was produced. You know, people would go into schools and they'd emerge as gentlemen, and you could act like a gentleman, you would be a gentleman, and that involved certain codes of behavior and so on. That's not common anymore, really.
Yeah.
You don't get these schools where you learn to be a gentleman. It's still fairly common. Well, it still happens that people go and learn manners, you know, they do, but they don't necessarily do it in that formalized way. Manners and being polite and being appropriate are still important, but they're not as formal as they used to be.
Yeah.
It's a lot more informal now, and instead we have a sense that we just try and accept diversity, and that there are many different ways to behave, and each one is valid as long as you respect people's rights. You know, that's the main thing, is you respect the rights of diversity. You know, that I think there's a sort of pluralism in England these days, which is the idea that not, there is no one way that's correct. That as long as you as long as you respect certain principles, you don't have to be a gentleman, you know. As long as you're polite, and as long as you're not sexist, and as long as you're not racist, then that's all you need to do, really.
Yeah.
And so rather than there being specific codes of etiquette, it's more conceptual, ideological things. Like these days, the worst things you can do are be sexist or racist, sure. I think. Yeah. Outside of that, as long as you're respectful, then that's enough. But generally, people are a lot more relaxed and informal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, here we're getting back to the stiff upper lip that kind of prompted this part of the conversation. Because we, you know, that's generally associated with England, the old England, and a certain behavior that has been promoted a long time. And, for instance, through movies, it was only in recent decades that we saw that there's other type of people in England, and not just stiff upper lippers.
Yeah, it's a bit of a stereotype, the sort of English gentleman. You know, in Hollywood movies, like in Independence Day, for example,
right.
That's a good example. Independence Day, we talked about it in the previous episode. In that movie, it focuses mainly on America. The aliens come down, they invade the whole planet, including all the major cities in the world. What we see is what occurs in America, but they do land in London, the aliens. They blow up the Houses of Parliament. And there is one scene where we see little clips of leaders in different countries, and the leaders in the UK, it's like... it's like sort of super stereotypes of each different country. And in the UK, there they are in their suits and everything. It's like, golly gosh, there's aliens. What the ruddy heck are we going to do?
Right.
You know. So there is still this stereotype that all the English are sort of gentlemanly. You see it in Hugh Grant. He's very popular.
Yeah.
In reality, Hugh Grant isn't the character that he plays in a lot of his films. Absolutely. By no means.
I guess everybody knows it by now, maybe has even... forgotten, because
he's been out of the
spotlight.
Media.
But he was in the 90s, the
English guy, and he was like, I'm terribly sorry, you know, that kind of thing, like very nice, polite, unassuming.
But that was mostly promoted and still promoted by Hollywood, as you say. And what has come through English movies was different in this past decades, because you had the movies of, I guess, Ken Loach or Stephen Frears, who offered a completely other image of England and of people from different, you know, sides of the country, of life, ways of life. And before that, I guess there had been like the 60s filmmakers, Tony Richardson, etc., who showed mostly, you know, young people enraged by the system, but those, they were still marginal then.
You're talking about the films from the 60s that focused on the angry young man.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The working class young men.
Still from that you know, area, but they were, I guess, the marginals then. Mm. But with Frears and Loach, they've shown slices of life that were normal, and, you know, just showing this is England too.
So, let's say a lot of those stereotypes have either been perpetuated by Hollywood movies, because that kind of English gentleman sells as an image, but also earlier than that, in Britain, we had lots of films that reflected how life was in the UK, but for a certain type of person. That there were English movies tended to focus on the sort of the slightly more middle class or upper class man from the south of England, let's say.
Yeah.
But then there were movies in the 60s about the angry young man. That was quite a popular character to have in a film at that time. Sort of working class young man who was aware of certain struggles for his rights,
right.
And he was angry about his position in the world, and so that was an interesting story to tell. And then since then, we've had films by people like Ken Loach,
right.
Who's a great English filmmaker, and they focus on working class people, basically. I think that's fair to say, from different areas of the country. So you hear all these different voices. It's not just the standard received pronunciation that you may have heard in the 50s and 60s in films, but instead we look at different social classes. And it, I think this is part of this movement towards accepting all types of person as equal. You know, it's not just that, it's a breakdown in the class system, let's say. So the voices of people from all backgrounds in England, or certainly in the UK, are more valid these days than they were back in the old days. So maybe that we'd imagine that would break down the stereotype of the Englishman. And I think that people more and more from around the world are learning that there are various different types of Englishmen and various different types of English voice. You know, it's not just received pronunciation or BBC English, but also you've got your sort of Cockney English, you know what I mean, Governor? You've got your sort of Liverpool accent like that from the Northwest, where people speak like that in Liverpool, Merseyside, footballers and that. And then you've got Manchester and you've got Newcastle, you know, different parts of Scotland. So yes, in fact, the stereotype of the English gentleman doesn't really work anymore.
But it took a while, even for British cinema, to kind of embrace that diversity and reflect it. So it was a decades process, because up until the 40s, what you saw was basically that, the gentleman, let's say.
Yeah. It's still there. I mean, you still get it every now and then, but it's the Englishman is a different character these days, I think. What was I going to say? I was going to say, since we're talking about stereotypes, let's have a little look at Romania, shall we?
Sure.
I know that many of my listeners will know plenty about Romania.
Maybe even too much.
Maybe some of them will know too much about it, and they wish that they didn't. Yeah. But some of my listeners will be living in Romania or living in countries in that region. But I know that many other listeners to Luke's English Podcast will not be that clued up about Romania and everything that we should know about it. What do you find are the standard stereotypes that people have about your country?
Yeah, well, that's certainly a good question, because I don't know if I'm very objective, but in recent years we've seen this with the people being afraid by the Romanians who'd come to work in the Western countries and kind of occupy the working spots.
Yeah,
and that's probably now the most current thing.
Yeah,
whether this kind of scare that was in Great Britain a couple of years ago, when the market opened for other people to come and work on the on British soil, and there was a huge scare, of course, fueled by certain politicians.
Mm-hmm. And still happening now, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it started with the current affair, I would say.
Yeah.
And that kind of, wasn't confirmed, because they were expecting like a wave of people from the East and from Romania and Bulgaria on the 1st of January.
This year.
And there were a couple, I guess, or one dude. And so nobody showed up immediately, because people, of course, are cautious and need to prepare for that. Even if, of course, Romanians want to work abroad, because that would give them other chances. And we've seen that in other countries where... And they've become very integrated and successful.
So, what we're talking about is the fact that, this year, 2014, right at the beginning of the year, was the moment when Romanians and Bulgarians were given the right to come and work freely in Europe. Okay, and so in the news, in England, the media was full of stories about this, about the fact that. Romanians and Bulgarians were about to come to England and steal people's jobs. Now, not everyone in the media was paranoid about the influx of Romanians into England. Not everyone was paranoid about it. Only certain groups, so certain sort of right-wing politicians, particularly members of a political party known as UKIP, that's the United Kingdom Independence Party. That's been one of their big issues that they talk about a lot, is immigration. And they made a point of saying that there would be a tidal wave of migrant workers coming from Romania into Britain, and Britain would be flooded with Romanians who would steal everyone's jobs. Okay, a big controversial thing to say. Lots of people in the media, you know, the left-wing press, for example, disagreed with it and said it was racist and all that kind of thing. But in France as well, it's the same thing. The French, some French politicians strongly disagreed with the movement of, you know, the free movement of labour in the European Union, saying that France would be flooded with immigrants from Romania and they're going to come and steal our jobs. Do you want to have to live next door to a Romanian? All this kind of thing. Now, how do you feel about this stuff, about what politicians say about Romanian migrants?
Yeah, well, that's obviously something that's constructed by politicians, and I guess people in general know better people from the respective countries, because they have had other examples of people who have already been here for years, who are fully integrated and who are working well and don't really can't listen to this because it's obviously not true. And France also has been more protective with the work market than other countries in Europe, who welcomed workers from the East much earlier, like Italy, Spain. Before the crisis, you know, people would really go there in groups and work there and earn obviously more money than in Romania. So that happened because it was easier then, and then of course with the crisis things kind of slowed down. So what I can say from my experience is that I've never really felt like the focus of this sort of consideration from the people I've encountered myself.
You've never been sort of subjected to those kinds of views.
But I know this exists, and there are, you know, it can get to extremes sometimes, and so I've been probably protected because I've been into certain milieus where that was not an issue, because they were already very international.
You mean you exist in circles where people are more open-minded?
Exactly. When I was studying, this was a very international school. 50% of the students were from abroad. And so everybody was open-minded. Now, as working in the cinema business or in audiovisual projects, people of course are from everywhere coming, circulating. That's the basic principle of this kind of projects, and so that's not an issue. But in smaller communities, it happens, and there's also of course this sort of ethnic typecasting, and I'm thinking obviously of the gypsies, the Roma people, who have been very much the target of this, probably because there were also reasons to fear them, but also because of politicians using that. And it's easier when we're talking about people who are behaving so differently from any, you know, Western behavior. So it's easier to target them.
So I suppose, like, a lot of the time these politicians were generalizing about Romanians and using one small group, as you say, the gypsy or Roma community, and suggesting that all Romanians were that.
Yeah, that happens. So since we're talking about cliches, certainly this sort of mix-up is disturbing and unpleasant, but it's something that can be, I think, can be fought on a day-to-day basis, because it's, I mean, you can see that there are reasons to fear problems, but then you get reactions, which what happened here in France recently, where one of these people was kind of beaten up into a coma.
Really?
Yeah, a young a gypsy guy who was probably had done some stealings and he was
done some theft. Because I have,
yeah,
I have
sorry.
To be honest,
I was, that was an English slippage.
Stealing.
Yeah.
Well, stealing is a word.
Yeah,
stealing is
yeah,
fine.
Yeah. But they're not as good as yours.
Well, I just to be honest, I just wanted to get a word in. That's because good. I wanted to just say that I do see in Paris, and you probably do too, there are groups of gypsies who kind of hang out in the centre of Paris, and it's only a small, you know, minority of people, but you get these groups who are kind of scamming people. They have clipboards they have clipboards, and they try to interview you with a clipboard, and it's a scam. And while they're talking to you with a clipboard, they might put their hand in your pocket, or they're quite opportunistic. They take opportunities to maybe pickpocket you or something.
They have a colleague who does that if they're not doing it themselves.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
Are they Romanian?
Well, many of these gypsies come from Romania and Bulgaria, I guess, but that part of the of Europe. So I
guess what maybe happens is that some people see these people and they think that that's what Romanians are.
Yeah.
And they're wrong.
Definitely one of the big problems. On the other hand, they're not very integrated in Romania either. Mm. Some parts or some categories not at all.
Yeah.
And so it's easier for them to move. Mm-hmm. That's kind of their tradition to move where it's better.
Yeah.
So they're using these opportunities to now with Europe, they are kind of updated tradition.
Yeah.
And so of course that's you can go back and think, why are they not integrated? Is it just their culture, or was it the government's fault in Romania? And certainly that had been a problem for years, because even during the communist regime, they were kind of stigmatized and marginalized, and these kind of ghettos existed. I don't, there was not enough access to schooling, to education, and that was certainly perpetuated.
Right.
So I think this is a very slow, long process.
Yeah.
It can happen, in a quick manner. It couldn't happen in 2007 when Romania integrated the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly will take a long time and patience. I don't know if there's much progress lately. There have been some European projects that maybe were successful. I don't really have a lot of information on that, but I would be happy to hear if this was the case. I remember famously a case about marriage at a very early age.
Yeah,
because this happens in these communities. Like kids would get married, like teenager to 12, 13 easily.
Get married at
because the families arrange that, and it's sort of a tradition. And that was, I think, a French organization.
Yes.
Went there and kind of tried to educate the people in the region and explain this can be done, and etc.
Right, you mean some people in that community in France?
No, that in Romania.
In Romania.
Yeah, as I said, European programs that would even come to Romania to try to change things
for
the better.
So for example, French like social workers or whatever were going to Romania in order to try and tell these people, you really shouldn't be getting married at 13 years old.
Especially with, European Union knocking at the door at the time.
Yes.
Now it's inside, sort of.
Okay. So you mean they were sort of preemptively going there as if to say, right, you're going to be in the European Union soon, and this kind of marrying when you're 13 is not really okay in the European Union. So, maybe you could stop doing that. And
yeah, exactly.
And what, did they have success?
And the guys listened very carefully and, of course, confirmed that this is not possible, and they will no longer do this, and there were probably some money or material aids involved, and then the social workers left, and the next day of course they celebrated such a marriage, because they had this couple waiting for to
so
to
it
be
made
happy.
It made no difference,
even
though the people they went to see were like, oh yeah okay it's bad, all right, we'll stop doing it, oh thanks for this money, that's going to help us a lot. And then the social workers went, bye, let's get married.
Yeah
so it made no difference.
So it's not going to be that easy or that short of a process. It's going to be a very long one, obviously.
Okay, so it's going to take a long time. All right, so that's the sort of immigrant workers thing that we've just dealt with. Now, I've got another stereotype about Romania that I'm sure many people have. And that is the Transylvania thing.
Yeah, right?
Well. But when you meet someone from Romania, I've seen it in a stand-up comedy gig. I've seen it in comedy gigs before. When, you know, the comedian often will talk to the audience and say, "So, where are you from?" And the person will tell them where they come from, and then the comedian will make a few jokes and some conversation about it to warm up the audience. I've seen it before. Whenever there is a Romanian in the room, the comedian would always say, "Oh, where are you from? Transylvania?" And, you know, "We've got a vampire in the room."
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So it's the vampire myth.
Yeah.
Because vampires come from Transylvania, Dracula.
Yeah, which is English literature.
Yeah.
We should mention that Bram Stoker, the British writer of Irish descent, he was Irish, basically, but active in... Great Britain.
Yeah.
And he wrote this book, Dracula, in 1897. He was on riding the wave of vampire fiction, which was already in place. He didn't invent any vampire.
Uh-huh.
But what he did, he linked briefly in the book Dracula the Vampire with this Romanian warlord and ruler in the 15th century, who was very bloody in his own right.
He was a real person?
Absolutely.
His name was Dracula?
He was. That was sort of a nickname based on a sort of a distinction that he had from he was knighted, and that knighthood had a dragon on the on the coat of arms, and so the sort of was linked in popular
imagery
with the Dracula, the dragon or the devil, kind of sort of a mix up of the
two. I see. So when all right, so he was knighted, he became Count Dracula.
No, there was no count. He was a ruler. He was a voivode, which is sort of like a prince. He was ruling over this, what is now the south of Romania, was a sort of small country, independent, more or less, back then.
So hold on. So the original Dracula was a real person who was a kind of an aristocrat who ruled over an area of Romania in the 15th century, and he was quite bloody. I mean, he had quite a violent reign.
The impaling thing was true. Like, he would like to take an enemy and just let him sink slowly on this spike and die a slow death. And it's reputedly he was also enjoying sort of a meal on that field with spikes.
Right. So you mean he would eat what would
something.
He
would we
eat,
don't know what.
Eat.
obviously not. There wasn't any cannibalism involved or confirmed. But he was also, that was true, but he was also sort of the focus of negative propaganda by his opponents, mostly kind of a Transylvanian nobleman, and they printed materials against him,
propaganda,
and popularized this image, and probably many images that we have of him come through this channel.
I see.
And the information that Stoker probably had also was coming from through these channels.
So this ruler, Dracula, 15th century, he was subjected to demonization. He was demonized by his enemies.
Yeah.
And they made him into a monster.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And Bram Stoker was influenced by this story of this real person.
Yeah, yeah. I guess was looking for some context, historical, geographical context for his vampire, because he wanted to give more background to the guy.
But and it worked.
It worked, famously, because it became the most successful vampire in literature, in movies, and now in everything.
Yes.
Now we don't know. There's no definite medium. Dracula is not contained to one medium.
It's not just
everywhere.
He's not just movies or books.
Even now with us.
He moves.
I feel it.
He moves everywhere
in mysterious ways.
Yeah,
as the song goes. that was. And it's connected to what we were discussing earlier, because when Bram Stoker wrote it in the late 19th century, it was echoing the fear for this immigration waves of people from the East, from Eastern Europe, coming over to Great Britain. Immigrants were everywhere. It was also a period where people moved a lot.
So Bram Stoker exploited the fear that British people had of migrant workers coming from the East, for example, Romania. He exploited that sort of sense of fear of the East.
Yeah, I don't know if the focus was on workers back then. It was just people who would come with, you know, different manners, different way of being, kind of soiling the blood, actually the metaphor of the blood is the key to understanding all this. And it was in, you know, more recent interpretations obviously linked to a sexual disease.
Yeah.
Because the big scare then in the 19th century, late 19th, was syphilis.
Right.
And it's easy to read into the whole blood problem that's at the center of Dracula, the scare of sexually transmitted disease that Dracula would bring with him. So that was definitely back then. It's more diffuse right now because now we're talking about work, because that's what people are very concerned with right now, especially since 2008
with the financial crisis.
Yeah, so we can, I don't know, we can maybe draw the conclusion that people would be more okay with VD than with no work.
Right. People are more okay with having a sexually transmitted disease than they are with being unemployed.
Yeah.
So the big fear is unemployment and financial difficulty rather than sexually transmitted diseases. Yeah. I think there's a good reason for that. The reason being that if you do pick up a sexually transmitted disease, you can get it fixed.
Most of them today are.
You go to the doctor and they'll sort it out, unless it's
AIDS.
Unless it's AIDS, of course. But that's not quite as serious as it was. Wait a minute. Obviously, AIDS is a deeply serious disease, but it's more treatable than it has been before.
Yeah. But you know, even that the movie Dracula made by Coppola in 1992 was echoing that, because everybody was by then aware of AIDS and it was not treatable in almost no way than 1992, and that was very cleverly put forth. I mean, he updated the idea of sexually transmitted disease as being the metaphor in Dracula.
Yes.
As you open in London with Van Helsing, the professor who then chases Dracula. But as you find him at the beginning of the movie, he's delivering a course on VD.
VD?
Venereal
disease.
So it's it already puts the focus on that. And that was linked to AIDS, because that was a big scare then.
So he puts venereal disease, sexually transmitted disease, right at the front of the movie. This is Bram Stoker's Dracula as filmed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
That's like the...
So now I'm getting the idea that since originally Dracula was this the syphilis, then it was updated. He became sort of a romantic figure with cinema, but obviously linked to such problems as AIDS into the 90s. So now I guess if you would do a Dracula now, a really modern day Dracula, he would have to be the sort of vampire who doesn't suck blood, but he really gets everybody else's work. He would get all sorts of jobs because he would have the possibility to move very fast.
Well, I guess he would take away people's financial security, wouldn't he? Like, would Dracula be a banker, do you think? Would he be a very charming banker who sells you some real estate? I mean, we're back to the Wolf of Wall Street now, aren't
we? Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the Wolf of Wall Street, it's interesting they called him the Wolf of Wall Street, because the wolf is another character from horror.
Yeah.
The werewolf.
Dracula can transform himself or itself into a wolf.
That's true. Yeah. So maybe Dracula would be a banker. And he would, instead of draining the blood out of someone's body, he'd drain all the finances out of your bank account.
But that's a more serious approach that you're taking, and I respect that. But I'm thinking if you would do a comedy, I think Dracula would be the guy who'd steal every job on the market. He would just wake up and open the newspaper and apply for every job and get every job.
But I think that we would find it hard to be truly afraid of this guy, because on one hand you think, yes, okay, he's stealing people's jobs, but on the other hand, what he, you know, at least someone is applying for work. At least someone's willing to prop up the economy. You know, like that's a double-edged sword. The image of Dracula being a hard worker, because right. we also love the hard worker, don't we? Because it's very important that we have people who work hard and are willing to do jobs, because that's so important for the economy.
Yeah. It's a comedy.
We would fear someone who does no work and yet reaps and all the benefits.
Those
spots. Takes all the goodness out and yet contributes nothing back. I think that's what we would be scared
sure,
of.
Sure.
I think the banker. I think the I'm still sticking with the image of the banker.
Look, I'm willing to go with that.
I reckon he's a hedge fund manager.
Yeah, yeah.
Not who is not domiciled in the UK, but who is reaping all the benefits of our tax law. You know?
Yeah.
I think that's probably it. But I think it's... I'm getting political now.
Well, it's...
And is Dracula is a political thing, isn't it?
As we've just said. That's really... Because, you know, the blood thing, it's kind of outdated.
Well, but I think the blood thing has always been just a metaphor, hasn't it? I mean, it's a metaphor relating to disease, venereal disease, as you say. There's also, the sexual aspect to it too. But, you know, finance has always been linked to liquid metaphors. The world of finance, the language of finance is full of liquid metaphors. Cash flow, liquidity, you know, all this sort of stuff. So I think it works. But you'd be hard-pressed to make a story about a banker sexy and exciting, don't you think? I'm being a bit rude to bankers at this point, I realise but you shouldn't blame me for that. If you're a banker and you're listening to this, or if you know a banker who's listening to this, then don't blame me for being rude about bankers. Who you should blame is that minority, that small group of unethical bankers who ruined it for everyone, okay?
Yeah, but they're still, they can be of interest. You pointed out The Wolf of Wall Street, and then there was famously Wall Street, you know, the movie, the hero Gordon Gekko, Michael Douglas.
Greed is good.
Yeah, so they can still be appealing, and certainly that kind of guy is sort of a Dracula type of guy.
Yeah, Gordon Gekko as a Dracula.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was also the great film called American Psycho.
Sure.
Which was a good horror film about the sort of moral question and the moral... Hold on, sorry. I just paused the podcast there for a second. We were in full swing, full flow, as it were, talking about vampires and bankers and everything, really. But I've just realised what time it is, Corneliu.
Yeah.
And it's late.
It's way past any decent
hour.
It's 7:30 in the afternoon.
So. It's 7:30 in the afternoon. I've realised I've got an appointment at 8 o'clock. I absolutely must... cut off the conversation now. It's a pity, because we were in some very interesting territory there.
Yeah, now I'm very guilty, because I made, you know, Luke, who is obviously an English gentleman, I'll make him be late at this appointment, so it's not okay of me, but you can blame it on me. People from the East came and took my time.
Okay.
And they've drained the afternoon of seconds, minutes, hours.
I think that's a perfect way to end, Corneliu.
Yes, I agree.
But I really must go. I must dash right away. I've got to go. So thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Luke, for having me.
It's been very interesting.
It is. It has been for me. And if there's any echoes, I want to hear them. Good, bad, mediocre echoes to our conversation.
Well, I would invite listeners to leave their comments on the webpage as usual. Please do. Corneliu, in particular, is very interested to hear your feedback, to read it, negative, positive, or anywhere in between. Please do leave your thoughts and comments on teacherluke.co.uk. But for this episode, it's time to say goodbye.
Yes.
And so we're going to do that right now. Thanks again, Corneliu. It's been great to have you here.
Thank you.
But for now, it's goodbye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.